Over the next 2 weeks, leaders from nearly 200 countries are gathering in Glasgow, Scotland for a United Nations climate summit known as COP26. They'll tell us what we've heard before, that scientists have warned about rising oceans, sinking cities, famines, and millions of climate refugees if we don't dramatically reduce carbon emissions. Officials will tell us that we need to act ASAP. But the fate of humanity really rests with a handful of countries. I'm Gustavo Ariano. You're listening to The Times, daily news from the LA Times. It's Monday, November 1st, 2021. Just five nations are responsible for nearly 60% of the world's carbon emissions. China, the United States, India, Russia, and Japan. Throw in the European Union, Brazil, and a few others, and that's the bulk of the problem. The world is at their mercy. So today, we're gathering our panel of correspondents from across the globe to focus on some of the most crucial countries and why it's so difficult for them to reduce their emissions. In August, the United Nations published a report on climate change calling it a code red for humanity. Their words, not mine. Even if we got rid of fossil fuels tomorrow, the planet would continue to warm for about another decade. Floods, fires, droughts, heat waves, everything that's hit us this year in the US and beyond can get much, much worse. All it'll take, according to scientists, is if the average global temperature rise compared to pre-industrial times surpasses 2.7 degrees. We're already at 2.2. So at this UN conference, most of the attendees are essentially spectators. The stakes are incredibly high for them, but they have little choice but to wait and see what the big players do. We've gathered our correspondents from across the world to discuss this, our world-famous world panel. David Pearson joins us from Singapore. Kate Linthicum is in Mexico City. Alice Su is checking in from China, and Victoria Kim from South Korea. Welcome, world panel.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Alice, let's start with you. No country is affecting climate change right now more than China. A report by the research firm Rhodium Group says China is responsible for 27% of global greenhouse gas emissions in 2019. That's more than the rest of the next three biggest emitters combined. The United States came in at second at 11%. India came in third at 6.6%, while the European Union countries combined were 6.4%. So, Alice, what do China leaders have to say about all that?
Yeah. So in many ways, China has such a huge impact on global emissions that it is really kind of the make it or break it country. You know, if China takes serious action on reducing emissions, then it's maybe possible for the rest of the world to make progress. But if China keeps on going with the track that it previously had with as many fossil fuel emissions as before, then China could single-handedly block the efforts of the rest of the world. What is interesting about what's happening right now is that China is participating in COP26 and we're having this big conference on climate. But at the same time that that's happening, there is a big energy crisis happening. So in China, basically what happened is that despite all the progress China has made on investing in renewables and expanding renewable capacity, they are still heavily dependent on coal. And this year, China spent a lot of energy, burned a lot of coal to pursue economic growth as part of their rebound from the coronavirus pandemic. And that meant that they focused quite a lot on heavy industry, on high emitting industries like cement and steel, basically infrastructure and construction. And then later on in the year, you know, coal prices began to rise. They used too much coal, and then basically they suddenly came up with an energy shortage, and they didn't have enough electricity for really basic things like heating people's homes. And so in recent weeks, China has been in this scramble to get as much coal as possible. And that, I think it's really quite discouraging to see, even though the leadership is serious about climate change and they have set these long-term goals. What you see in the short term right now is they're increasing coal imports. They are opening up more mines there. But it's understandable because people need warm homes to get through the winter. And that's kind of, it's a matter that affects political stability. You know, if people are unhappy, if they're cold and their homes are dark, but it just kind of reflects the complexity of making the energy transition.
It's the biggest polluter on Earth, yet the country has consistently argued that its blame in polluting the world should be minimal. Why?
Yeah, so that is an argument that China has relied on quite a lot in the past. What's interesting is that they have changed their tone in recent years. But say 10 years ago, when these climate talks began, China often fell back on this argument of common but differentiated responsibilities. And essentially, it's the idea that there's a division between the developed world and the developing world. China often argues that even though they are the number one emitter right now, the United States is still the top emitter per capita. And if you look at historical emissions, the developed world, so mostly the US, European countries, also Japan and South Korea, I believe, all together, kind of, if you look from a historical perspective, how much those countries have emitted is far more than developing countries. And China's argument was always, well, you guys, kind of, you developed countries got a chance to pollute as you grew, and then you became strong and powerful, and now it's our turn to become strong and powerful, and now you're suddenly saying we can't take the same path you did, this is unfair, and we should get a chance to rise. And so, therefore, in terms of cutting emissions, developed countries should take the lead, they should pay more, they should do more, and they should give developing countries a chance to go slower and to basically still keep emitting.
And David, India aligns itself with China on that exact same argument, but it's also a country heavily affected by the consequences of climate change.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, India is very similar to China in that posture, in that they feel like this is their chance to catch up with the developed world. And, you know, who are these rich countries to tell them that they should stop? Why did they get to enjoy the quality of life that they do today and India doesn't? So India is behind China in development. You know, it really sort of became modernizing in earnest in the 90s. And it is going to be increasingly important in the global fight against climate change, because no country is going to increase its energy usage more in the next 20 years than India. And like China, the big problem in India is that it has to rely on coal to power much of this growth. And weaning the country off coal is going to be very difficult, because coal is life over there. It provides millions of jobs. It's a way for the vast poor population in India to heat their homes, to cook. And, you know, it's so part of everyday life there that the hauling of coal on freight trains subsidizes the passenger trains there, so people can afford to ride very cheaply. Now, India's made a push to go solar. It is part of the Sun Belt in a way. And the problem is they will not commit to this net zero carbon like a lot of other countries are, richer countries are urging them to do. The belief is by 2050, if we're not at net zero, then we're in for some big problems. India just will not commit to that. It wants other countries, it wants rich countries to lower their energy intensity, to take more of the burden of trying to reduce their emissions. And now India, of course, you know, there's few countries in the world that have suffered more from climate change. The floods, droughts, you know, killer heat, you name it. India has suffered this for years and years. There's literally thousands of farmers killing themselves each year because their crops have been destroyed by this extreme weather. It's quite desperate over there, and because they don't have the infrastructure to handle, you know, changes in rainfall or the air conditioners for people to survive these heat waves, you know, they are feeling it more than most other countries.
Victoria, you cover Japan and South Korea, which are two of the world's largest polluters, but they also pride themselves on their technological innovations and expertise. Yet both countries seem really resistant to renewable energy. What's their reasoning?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that South Korea and Japan are not where they should be in terms of renewable energy, and they're way behind other advanced nations, given their stature in the world and their technological prowess in terms of like the makeup of their energy and how much of their energy like comes from renewables. It's still a small fraction in each country. Both are similar in that they are very mountainous countries that are very densely packed, which makes renewable energy expensive to install. So it's not very well suited for large-scale like solar panels or wind farms. The desire definitely is there from both countries. Both about a year ago made pledges to go carbon neutral by 2050. And ahead of COP26, they have dramatically increased their 2030 targets about how much they're going to cut their carbon emissions in the next decade. many critics still say it's not nearly enough and that it needs to get there faster. And even in terms of like the plans that are currently in place to get to those not quite high enough targets, that it might not be as feasible or well thought out or detailed. In the case of Japan, their progress towards like carbon cutting has definitely been dealt a blow by the 2011 triple disaster that included a nuclear meltdown. Japan used to drive a large part of its electricity from nuclear powers, and all nuclear reactors were taken offline after that disaster. And their current plan to go carbon neutral by 2050 includes restarting a lot of those reactors, which remains very politically unpopular domestically. And there are higher standards now for these nuclear reactors. So that's still a bit of up in the air, a bit in question.
Kate, whenever it comes to climate change in Brazil, it's always centered around the Amazon rainforest. And you were just there. What's happening?
Yeah, so Brazil is not one of the top 10, you know, biggest emitters in the world of carbon. Yet it is, you know, home to the Amazon. More than half of the Amazon is in Brazil's borders. And so it's kind of a linchpin in all of these efforts to reduce carbon. It's so important, and all rainforests are, because it has historically been what we call a carbon sink. Basically, forests sequester carbon. They hold a lot in the earth. And so when you log, when you burn parts of the forest to replace it with cattle or soybeans, which is what is happening in Brazil, all of that carbon goes out into the atmosphere. So what we have seen in recent years is a really alarming trend, which is the Brazilian Amazon, which was always a net carbon sink. Now parts of it are actually emitting more carbon than taking in. So that's a big problem because historically, the Amazon basically sucks up about 5% of our total emissions in the world. So we're losing that kind of critical counterbalance.
Yeah, no, the Amazon is always described as the world's lungs. And if those lungs are sickened, then there's not much hope for us out there.
Yeah, and it's, of course, a very political thing there. You know, Brazil had actually made kind of incredible strides in reducing deforestation in recent years. Over the last 20 years, there were really good policies that were successful. Then there was a financial crisis there about 5-6 years ago, and then the election of Jair Bolsonaro, who is very pro-business, very right-wing, and has sort of made it his job to dismantle a lot of environmental regulations. So you've seen kind of a lot of backsliding and just a huge amount of development in Brazil, which is what I saw. Kind of everywhere you looked, there were fields covered with cows and forests on fire.
We'll be back after this break. David, so I'm interested in this idea that if the five biggest carbon emitters, China, the US, India, Russia, and Japan, if those five countries would merely walk their talk on climate change, that we could avert disaster. Is it really that simple?
If these five countries start taking their targets seriously and make dramatic cuts to their emissions, there's still no guarantee that we're going to avert disaster. But there is no chance of averting disaster if these five countries don't get it together and lead the way. So it's critical that the US and China get together and hammer something out. They are the two most significant, largest powers in the world. The US can lead rich countries through what has basically been the biggest stumbling block in the fight against climate change for decades, which is this tension between rich and poor. The rich countries need to step up and acknowledge that they're responsible for 90% of all the emissions currently in the atmosphere. They need to share technology. They need to fund the switch to green energy in poor nations. They have to help mitigate climate change. They have to shoulder a lot more of the burden of this fight. Poor countries need to realize that they can develop all they want, but it won't matter in the end if everything's on fire. And so this is an existential question. It's an existential fight. And Japan, part of the rich countries, they need to do this. India plays a special place because unlike China, it's a lot poorer. But, you know, Indian writer Raghu Karnad wrote recently that, you know, India has changed the world before, even though it's poor, in the post-colonial era. You know, it became this massive democracy for other countries to follow. And it can do the same with climate change as well. If it can get together, it can be a beacon for poor countries to make the changes that they need.
We've been talking about what some of these countries are doing within their own borders, but Victoria, they're also fostering climate change by exporting production overseas and thus getting smaller countries to build factories that increase their carbon footprint.
Yeah, well, it goes to this idea of, you know, they may be pledging to go green in their own shores, but they were until very recently still fueling the demand elsewhere of these nations that have very real power needs. South Korea and Japan, who are the number two and three coal financiers after China in the world, have this year said they were going to stop funding new coal projects overseas. There appears to be still some wiggle room left for exceptions, certain types of coal projects that may go forward, the ones that are currently in progress. But like David said, it has to be a leading perspective that the technology has to be shared, that these countries are, you know, they have developed, they are now in a position where they should really be leading the charge to less carbon emissions and to a carbon neutral world. And in many ways, they're still not quite there. They both have very powerful industries that are, there is a lot of anxiety about the stability of power sources in these two countries who are not very resource rich. So they import a lot of their power. So there are these industry groups that are still pushing back against some of these steps and efforts, as ambitious as their political leaders may be. Both South Korea and Japan say that even in 2030, they want to derive a fifth of their power from coal.
Kate, so this COP26 conference is happening for the next 2 weeks. Brazil, again, home of the Amazon rainforest, the world's lungs. What's Brazil expected to say?
So I think Brazil is going to be making a pretty provocative argument, which is basically, if you want us to stop deforesting the Amazon, you should pay us to do that. You know, Brazil's vice president basically told journalists that they'll be pursuing that demand. And it kind of comes back to, you know, what you were saying about who historically is responsible for a lot of these emissions. And also that idea of the kind of nationalist moment that we're living in a lot of parts of the world, Brazil included. So for Bolsonaro, the president there, I think developing the Amazon, he sees that as a birthright for Brazilians. He sees that as the key to future development. So he's going to make that argument, which I think is actually a pretty interesting one. And probably if we want to actually meet these targets, the kind of thing we need to be considering.
Yeah, it goes back to that tension between the rich countries and poor countries that David and Victoria were talking about. So what's going to make these powerful countries change their ways?
I think there is some reason for hope. Rich countries are now starting to feel the effects of climate change, right? Because in Europe, they had this horrific flooding. We're seeing the heat waves and the fires on a regular basis in North America. This was a crisis that was felt by the poor for so long. It is now being felt by the developed world. So it is on our doorstep now. And that should galvanize people more than it did before. The other big thing that's coming down the pike is in this conference, they hope to come up with the rules for carbon trading. Carbon trading is a chance for polluters to buy carbon offset credits from countries that are polluting less. So the idea is you'll have some sort of equilibrium of carbon. And so if someone is doing really well cutting back on emissions, they could sell their credits to essentially a company or a country that's doing very poorly. And that just opens up a whole avenue of financing. Global financial markets will now sort of be activated in a way that they weren't before. And that should provide a boost, especially to developing countries looking for funding to build clean energy plants and do all the things that they need to do with infrastructure. I can't tell you that's going to make the difference, but these are things that are changing right now that could sort of stir the pot a little bit in the fight.
And Victoria, what are Japan and South Korea expected to tell the world?
As with a lot of these international conferences, the big announcements when it comes to South Korea and Japan have already been made in the lead up to the conference. And it's sort of the pressure of this conference upcoming that has made them make these big increases to their targets, which many say are still not enough. But it does seem to be that the urgency is definitely there in a way that it wasn't before, and the desire is there. It's a matter of the feasibility and the practical steps that these countries will take to get there. And at the same time, there's some reporting out from leaked documents that say there's some behind-the-scenes lobbying going on to decrease the urgency in a UN report about climate change. So at the same time, it seems publicly that the desire is there, but it might be what happens behind the scenes that actually sets the tone, and we may not be privy to that.
And finally, we started with China, we'll end with China. Alice, the country, of course, is battling with the U.S. to be the world power in this century. Are the both of them going to continue their flexing in Glasgow?
Yeah, I mean, for China, China is coming to this conference with the idea that they want to show up as a global leader on climate change and on the environment. And you can see that kind of in the domestic media and propaganda that has been coming out in recent years. So, I mean, for President Xi Jinping, he has this phrase, ecological civilization. It's one of his big slogans. The state media has printed commentaries about how, you know, China's vision based on Xi Jinping thought is superior to, you know, Western ideas of environmental protection. So in some ways, the way that China is approaching climate is being seen through this bigger lens of competition with the U.S. and competition with the West. And a big priority for the Communist Party is proving that the Chinese system is superior, basically, to democracy and to Western political systems. And climate is one area where they want to demonstrate that. And in some ways, this is a good and bad thing. On one hand, it means that climate can become a kind of political bargaining tool. America and China are kind of, they're not having a good relationship right now for many reasons, including Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, human rights, trade, technology, the South China Seas, all kinds of issues. And China kind of has been saying, you won't get us to cooperate with you if you're constantly criticizing us about these issues. So in that sense, that is hindering climate cooperation, especially at this conference, if China doesn't want to be seen as kowtowing to the U.S. and, you know, making a big change just because America told it to. They really want to be seen as, we're acting for our own reasons and we are a leader. On the other hand, some people say that competition with the U.S. could be a good thing, in the sense that if China sees America really stepping up and in doing things like, for example, funding renewable energy abroad, kind of, you know, drawing the world together in alliances to combat climate change. If the U.S. is able to do that, that drives China to kind of like what David was saying. You know, we can also mobilize our own block of countries, and we can also kind of shift the needle on climate change. And so, I mean, on the one hand, there's this doomsday scenario where you see if the U.S. and China don't do anything, then the whole world will not survive. But we can't give in to that kind of fatalism. I think one interesting perspective is that in some ways, developing nations, their expectations for China and the way that they relate to China could have significant impact on Beijing's behavior, and in some ways, even more than Washington's pressure.
And that was our world famous world panel. David Pearson from Singapore, Victoria Kim from South Korea, Alice Su from China, and Kate Linthicum from La Mera Capirucha, Mexico City. Thank you all ustedes for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of The Times. Daily news from the LA Times. Later this week, Mexican wine. Our show is produced by Shannon Lin, Denise Guerra, Melissa Kaplan, and Ashley Brown. Our engineer is Mario Diaz. Our editors are Shawnee Hilton and Lauren Rabb, and our theme music is by Andrew Eben. Special thanks to Mike Heflin and Alan Zarembo. Like what you're listening to? Then make sure to follow The Times on whatever platform you use. I'm Gustavo Arellano. We'll be back tomorrow with all the news in Desmadre. Gracias.